Good morning, everyone. Before I start, I want to just say that our good friend Susan Nelson was scheduled to talk to us this morning, and she's feeling under the weather. So I am pinch hitting for her. So I had time to change the program and change the calendar, but some of you today would have come across town to see Susan, and I am not Susan. So I'm sorry for not being Susan. I have never had a choice in the matter. Good morning. So this morning, I'm going to talk a little bit about one of the teachings from Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika in terms of Zazen. And I'm going to start by reading a short passage from Dogen Zenji. He's a pretty pretty big troublemaker in our tradition, and he shows up here a lot. And I thought about putting this on the cover of the program, but I was afraid the type would get too small. But it's a verse a lot of you have heard many, many times. It's one of the more commonly quoted sections of Dogen. And when it's pulled out of its context, it's often referred to as the verse on the circle of the way. So a lot of you have heard this. It's part of Bendawa, and Bendawa is one of Dogen's most popular essays. He says, "On the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way, and it is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is unstained, not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so." So that's familiar to some of you? I'm seeing some nodding. It's considered core Dogen because he includes in that short piece not only the power of his vision of interconnectedness, how our practice affects the earth and the sky and all the 10 directions, but also his marriage of practice and realization. It's fundamental to Dogen, fundamental to Soto Zen. So it's actually a beautiful section. The circle of the way. but here's what I put on your programs, and this is the verse I was referring to from Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, for those of you who are newer, is a very, very well-known, especially in the Buddhist tradition, Indian logician, Indian philosopher. When did he live? I should know this. And I forgot.
I don't know, 100 BC, I believe.
You know, I was going to guess time of Christ, give or take 100 years, you know. And he wrote something, he actually wrote a lot, but the Mula Madhyamaka Karika is kind of his masterwork, it's sort of his central piece. That title is usually translated something along the lines of verses from the middle. Fundamental verses of the middle way is the most common translation we have in English by a man named Jay Garfield. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And one of the core teachings of that is from verse 8, and it's a very, very short section. And Nagarjuna says, "In seeing things to exist or to not exist, we fail to see a world at ease. In seeing things to exist or to not exist, we fail to see a world at ease." That's actually the entire Mula Madhyamaka Karika. It comes back to that over and over and over. And what he does in the course of this, it's a brilliant philosophical tome. is he uses the technique of deconstruction to see how we create patterns and ideas in our mind, and how those become real to us, and how we base our lives and we frame our experience based on those patterns. But that the pattern itself is fundamentally incomplete, fundamentally untrue. It's essentially a misunderstanding of how the world is. And much of this piece ends up bringing us to places very much like what he's inviting us into today on your program, in seeing things to exist or to not exist. So he's saying, if you don't see the world at ease, it's because you think things exist, or you think things don't exist. That's your problem. This is the point in the talk where you laugh, because that is absurd. Your problem is you think things exist or they don't exist. That's your problem. And right, 99.9% of them, I'm like, yes, I'm pretty sure that the things that I think exist exist, and the things I think don't exist don't exist. So I am forever landing on denial or assertion, right? I'm forever landing on one of those two things, right? Busho exists or Busho doesn't exist, but one of those two things has to be true. And he goes, oh, there's your problem. That's why you don't see the flow. That's why you fail to see this is already at ease. So this is, I want to say it's confusing stuff, because when I taught the class on the Garjuna here however many months ago, it was, even the conversations around the teaching are almost impossible to have, because language by itself is constantly asserting something or denying something. I mean, language is dualistic by nature. So to even try to have a conversation around it, the sentences were filled with self-contradictory ideas all the time. Very, very difficult to talk about. But anyway, here's where I'm going today. I want to talk about what this means to us as Zazen practitioners, as Zen students, as meditation students. I want to talk about what this means for us, this idea of Dogen's Circle of the Way, and how Dogen is always referring to and stealing from and borrowing and reframing Nagarjuna. He does teachings of emptiness all the time, Dogen does. And it does a lot of framing of what it is we do right here in this building in 21st century America. So what I'm going to read for you is from chapter 2 of Mula Madhyama Kakarika, verses 18 through 21. Garfield calls this the investigation of coming and going. Other translators say, oh, that's the chapter about walking. But he's talking about movement. So it's comprised of four statements. Nagarjuna says, it is incorrect to say walking and a walker are the same. It is incorrect to say walking and a walker are different. If whatever is walking were a walker, it would follow that the walker and the walking would be the same too. If walking and a walker were conceived of as different, there could be no walking without a walker and a walker without walking. So if things are not established as the same or as different, how can they be established? It's almost like Dr. Seuss, isn't it? If things are established as are not established as the same or as different, how can they be established? What a great question. And all it's showing us, folks, is the patterning of consciousness. It's showing how pervasive our pattern is to insist that things are the same or that they are different. And the reason I'm quoting this verse on walking is because, for whatever reason, in my experiences teaching this class and being in this class, the walker and the walking example really resonated with people. A lot of his teachings are so conceptual that they're hard for us to get into our head. But when I investigate, can there be such a thing as walking without someone walking? That's a little bit more concrete. Like, just show me walking, but don't show a walker. Show me a walker, but no walking. And you can sort of feel in your head how it doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work. They have to mutually arise. They have to be identical. They can't be separate, or else you'd be a walker without it. Right? You're sort of following. And because he's an Indian logician, his meticulousness is to break it down every possible permutation so that he's using the power of discursive consciousness to show you the limitations of discursive consciousness. He uses this to go beyond this. It's brilliant, actually. So he leaves us in this place where he says, we can't say that walker and walking are the same. We can't. We also can't say that walking and walker are different. And then he leaves us with our question. If they're not established as the same or as different, what do we say? We have to say something. What do we say about the nature of reality? What do we say? I know that this thing that I like to call Busho and this thing that I like to call podium are not the same. I also know that they're not different. What do I say? What do I say? We have to say something. So in Zen, we have a saying, not one, not two. That's a great summation of Nagarjuna. I can't say that walking and walker are the same. I can't say they're different. In Zen, we might also say no gap. There's no gap. And no gap doesn't mean identical. No gap just means no gap. So in contemporary Zen, we're very fond of quoting Katagiri in this temple because he's our founder. And we're fond of quoting Suzuki Roshi, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. They were both very prolific teachers, very gifted teachers. And Suzuki Roshi is quoted as saying, don't ever think you sit Zazen. Zazen sits Zazen. This is that same teaching again. But of course it needs you to be there. Can't happen without you. I mean, it'd be kind of a cute little, like, sort of Zen student loophole if it'd be like, I'm doing Zazen right now, but that's happening in the bedroom, you know, where my cushion is, but I'm just here on the couch watching Stranger Things. But don't worry, Zazen is sitting Zazen, so it looks like I'm slacking off. But seriously, Zazen's taking care of it right now. Zazen needs Busho's body to walk down the hall and to do the bows and to cross his legs and to sit. But it would be a misunderstanding to think, I sit Zazen. You know, we're constantly pushed up against this kind of stuff in Zen. So here's my probably completely blasphemous rewrite of Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika verses 18 through 21. Because our Zazen and us are not two, and they're not one. That's Dogen's idea, right? The way practice and enlightenment are not two, and they're not one. We have practice. So we talk about that a lot here. I'm a Zen practitioner. Oh, you're a Zen practitioner. Oh, yes, yes, what do you practice? I practice Zen. I have a thing called Zen practice. And when I set up a meeting with my teacher, I go and talk to her or him about my practice. What's going on in your practice? Right? How was your walk? When you were going on your walk, was there a walk happening without you? Are you and the walk identical? Are you the walker? Are you the walking? How about your practice? Are the practice and the practitioner the same, or are they different? So my rewrite is, it is incorrect to say practice and a practitioner are the same. It is incorrect to say practice and a practitioner are different. If whatever is practicing were a practitioner, it would follow that the practitioner and the practice would be the same too. If practice and a practitioner were conceived as different, there could be practice without a practitioner and a practitioner without practice. If things are not established as the same or as different, how can they be established? So Dogen talks about practice being a circle. Suzuki says, don't sit Zazen, let Zazen sit Zazen. They're choosing ideas and images, the metaphor of the circle, the idea of no self on the cushion, to show us our patterns, to show us the way we normally think of something. And more importantly, to show us the limitation of that pattern, and most importantly, to show us the suffering that either is or will arise as a result of that limitation. Sooner or later, the limited idea will hurt. Sooner or later, the limited idea will get in your way. Does that kind of make sense? Have you noticed in just the course of your life around making big changes, you know, your job, your relationship, your where you're going to live, what you're going to be when you grow up, you sort of see the self-imposed glass ceiling, the assumption you just make around what those limits are, and then you live from them, and you sometimes have a conversation or hear a song or see a sunrise or something that all of a sudden helps you see, oh, that limit was made up. That was totally made up. I believed it, and so I lived from that place for 6 months, or for a year, or for 85 years. And only now, when I look back to it, I go, oh my God, that was just an idea. It was never real. Wow, right? The reason we play so much around limits in this tradition, the reason we play so much in fields that show us our own creation, the things we create with our hearts and mind, is just so that we know we're doing it. When you know you're doing it, you've got agency. You have a choice. Like, do you see that you're building that thing over and over? Do you see that you're building that statue to your own pain? Do you see that you're building that god of cruelty and judgment that you're worshiping? You're doing that. I just want you to see that you're doing it. Because when you see that you're doing it, you have a choice. You have a choice. So much of Zazen, so much of Zen teaching, and certainly stuff like Nagarjuna, is only acting as a mirror. These are the patterns that I create. When I notice that that's happening, I have agency, and I can make a choice about which ones I want to pursue that are helpful for me, and which ones I want to let go of. And even the ones that are helpful to me, that I want to continue to pursue, that I want to continue to cultivate, even the awareness this is made up is actually really helpful. I just think it's really helpful to know, oh, we're making this up. I'm doing it. It doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean it's not helpful. It doesn't mean it's not beautiful. But it's just helpful to know that we make it up. I just think it's helpful to know that my ideas around walking and my ideas around a walker, they're ultimately not true. It's just part of reality. It's just part. I'm making it up. Ah. The reason I think that's helpful is because then I hold it lighter. I just don't grab onto it quite so tight. I'm not quite so insistent that my vision be the vision. The way is a circle. Arrgh. How dare you suggest it's a tetrahedron? That's not even a word. Right? Come on, man. Dogen said it's a circle. if you haven't met any Zen fundamentalists, hang around here long. It happens. We all just love that. Okay. Okay, so Suzuki Roshi also said, strictly speaking, there are no... He was asked about the nature of enlightened people. Oh, are you an enlightened person? Or what does an enlightened person do when they blah, blah, blah? We're really big on that in Buddhism because we have this idea that there are enlightened people and non-enlightened people. And then when I practice long enough and I reach this place, I'll cross this glorious threshold called enlightenment. I will therefore be an enlightened person. I will have arrived. That's a much more linear model of practice. And there's truth to it. It's relative truth. Suzuki Roshi says, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity. There's no such thing as a walk. There's just somebody doing that movement. There's no such thing as a walker. There's just walking. Right? I mean, I walked from my car to here. I was a walker then. Now I'm not. Right? That action doesn't define me any more than I define that action. They can't exist apart from one another. There are no enlightened people. There's only enlightened activity. And that's actually easier to understand in a Zen context, because if you are the one who is there and being enlightened already, that's not. Right? Don't sit Zazen. Zazen sit Zazen. My ideas about myself are going to get in the way. So when Dogen talks about practice being a circle, he's doing something that to me feels very friendly. About 50% of the time. 50% of the time, I experience this teaching as extremely helpful and very, very friendly. And the other 50% of the time, I experience it as very helpful and really irritating. And you get why, right? Because if the path is a line, then I've got a nice thing called the beginning, I'm used to those. I've got something somewhere in the middle called a middle, roughly speaking. I'm used to those. And then I have something at the end called an end. Ah, I'm used to those. Right? I started working for that company on that date. I worked there for 5 years, so about 2.5 years, and I was in the middle. And then when I quit, it was my last day. It was a line. It was a beginning and a middle and an end. Right? I started high school on that date, and I graduated on this date. Ah, beginnings and endings. I started practice in 1993 when I first walked in the back door of Minnesota Zen Center. And then when I'm done, I don't know what the end will look like. I guess when I'm dead, that would be the end then, maybe. A more commonly held idea is, well, you practice because you're practicing to get something, and so you'll be done when you get your enlightenment. Like when that finally arrives in the mail? I'm assuming it's FedEx, I don't know. I ordered it back in 1993. I've been very patient, frankly. I got a sign for it. I got to be there. And it'll arrive, and it'll arrive on the cushion on day 7 of Rohatsu, or it'll arrive when I'm not expecting it at home, but it'll be during Zazen. It'll be really sacred, and this thing will happen, and then I will have arrived, and that'll be the end, because practice was designed to get me there, and everything makes sense, right? That's what we do. I went to college to become the thing. This was training to become the thing. This is a means to an end. This is how we normally think of activity. I am doing this to get that. I'm doing this to get that. I'm giving you the dollar, so you give me the candy bar. I'm in it for the candy bar. I'm not in it for giving you the dollar. Right? So I'm not into Zen practice for the hours and 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 hours of sitting here and staring at the stupid wall. I'm in it for that FedEx package that's going to arrive someday called, oh, that's what I'm in it for. And if there was a way of expediting shipping, I would do it. I'm an Amazon Prime member, my God. Why are they making me wait? So, oh dear. That is my normal understanding. So when Dogen says the practice is a circle, the reason I experience that as helpful and irritating half the time and helpful and comforting the other half of the time is he's telling me I'm already there. It's a circle, right? When you're walking in a circle, start and end means nothing. There is no start or end. Every step you take is it. You're arriving. There it is. You're arriving. You're done. Every step is the first step. Every step is just a step, right? It takes away all of our ideas about attainment. It takes away all of our ideas about a means to an end. It takes away all of the judgment that we normally add to those activities. And half the time, like I say, it's really comforting when someone says, you don't have to worry about getting there faster. You're there. It's okay. You've arrived. You're here right now. To sit Zazen right now. To just sit there. To just sit there. That's it. That's all you have to do. And I experience relief. I experience some opening, some spaciousness, even some joy. This is all I have to do. Right? They're just telling me, you're already succeeding. This is the thing, right? And the other half of the time I find that really hard because they're saying, this is it. And I'm like, this can't be it. This is horrible. I hate this. It's why I'm here, to have less of this and to get to the other thing that is not this. Hello? Why would anybody ever do this if this was this? No, this is not this. This is going to come later. I've read all the books. I've read your fancy flowery sutras. I know this isn't it because this is angry at my wife and still sad about this and the election and my back pain and my cat that's sick. I mean, don't tell me that this is nirvana because if this is it, ugh, right? Return to sender. Wow, the circle. Play with this idea in your heart, this idea of making practice a circle. Play with it a little bit and see how it shows up for you. Yeah, see how it shows up. It's incredibly challenging. Because it's doing the same thing that Nagarjuna is doing. He's just not letting us land. He's just not letting us land. Because we kind of can say it's practice. We kind of can say it's nirvana. We kind of can say it's aspiration. We kind of can say it's enlightenment. Dogen's like, yep, they're all one thing. Right? So, so in practice being a circle, the minute, the moment, the instant you begin taking a step, you have arrived. You keep arriving every moment. And in this view of in this view of the path, you do not journey toward enlightenment. When you're on a circle, you're not moving toward anything, right? You're not moving toward anything. You're just letting enlightenment unfold. And even unfolding can be a tricky word because that can suggest progress. That's true to say, though. It's true to say that the very first time you walked in the store, the very first time you read something by Jon Kabat-Zinn, or the very first time you decided to set a timer and sit still for 5 minutes, that was it. You weren't lacking anything. The path was showing up in its completed manifestation. Everything's right there. And it's also true to say, that was just 5 minutes, kiddo. You just started. There's a long way to go. Because it's also true with the idea that with each step we arrive, it's also true to say then, with each step we leave. We leave. We leave. The dynamism of experience is such that there is only moment. There is only moment. And past and future are two things I will never be able to touch, ever. I will never be able to experience, ever. I will never be able to touch, smell, taste, hold, see, hear. I will only be able to experience moment. I will only be able to experience moment. So it's true for me to say, and Nagarjuna would argue, neither are true. Every moment is arriving. Every moment is arriving home. Every moment is coming back, because there is no home other than this. And it's equally true, and in Nagarjuna's words, equally untrue, to say every moment is leaving. And now I'm leaving this. And now I'm leaving this. I'm always entering the unknown. Forever. Because I never know what's about to happen. Even when I think I know what's about to happen, I don't. So we call this leaving home. Leaving home. Leaving home. And we practice doing this on the cushion in what we call Zazen, just to remind us, we're doing it all the time. We can't do anything other than this. So, we never arrive at enlightenment, because arriving at enlightenment suggests that both we and enlightenment are abiding places, abiding things, and abiding states. And none of those things are true. We do not abide, and neither does enlightenment. That sort of makes sense, right? If I think I'm going to arrive at enlightenment, that suggests there's a me that's abiding, and it suggests that there's a separate thing called enlightenment that's also real and also abides. And since neither one of those things are true, I don't have to worry about it. It's kind of nice. So I saw a bumper sticker that somebody once was saying, oh, I saw the most Zen thing. I saw this bumper sticker that said, the dude abides. It's like the most Zen thing ever, and then there's a picture of somebody, there's a movie that's from. And I said, wow, that's the least Zen thing I've ever heard. Because no, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. Show me something abiding. Something permanent that just stays. Show me that. I was just being difficult. Because I kind of get where he was going. Like, oh, sitting without purpose or agency or agenda. Oh, yeah, I kind of get that. But you don't sit Zazen, Zazen sits Zazen, right? To describe Zazen, so I'm just abiding, it's just me, I'm just sitting there doing, I'm just sitting there and I'm engaged in the activity of abiding. You're like, mm-mm, you're misunderstanding it already. You've got a separation between you and that activity. You're suggesting you're a permanent thing. You're engaged in an abiding experience called abiding. You can't say that. There is no dude. There is no abiding. There's no the. None of this is an excuse to think of our practice as unimportant. And none of this is an excuse to think of our practice as finished. Or worse, to think of our practice as unnecessary. So practice is not finished, and practice is not incomplete. So the teaching that you are always arriving is true, and it is not true. And the teaching you never arrive is true, and it is not true. The teachings of Dogen, when he talks about practice and aspiration and practice and enlightenment in Nirvana being one thing, and the teachings of Nagarjuna when he says you can't insist that they exist and you can't insist that they don't. All these things are teachings to remind us, don't land. Don't land. Don't land. Don't land. When you land, you will misunderstand. That's what's going to hurt. Don't land. Right? Don't land. Live in the flux. Live in the not knowing. Live in at least understanding that the best I can do is hold a relative truth that is sometimes true. And it's sometimes skillful, and when it's not skillful, it's my job to let it go. To notice the human compulsion, and I do think it's a compulsion, to explain. We love to explain. We live for explanations. My pain will be easier to bear if I just understood what it was and what caused it. We love the explanation. I want to understand my relationships. That's hilarious. Don't you think? I have relationships in my life. I want to understand them. Wow! I can't even begin to understand even this thing that I call me, let alone another thing that isn't me. Or is it? I don't know. Oh my God, is there even a relationship? What's going on? Too much Zen. Right? Wow, understand, understand. And you understand what I mean by understand, right? Of course I want to understand my relationships. And yes, when I have a symptom, I want to investigate the disease. Of course, of course, of course. There's a beauty to that. It's actually part of why we're wired. It's part of the evolution of consciousness on this planet. And at the same time, it's so important to remember, I'm going to come up with a simplified map that I hope helps. I'm going to come up with a simplified map that I hope helps. But it's a simplified map. It's not the real deal. And as soon as it stops helping, pitch it. Right? When you move into Wisconsin, you throw away the Minnesota map. It's not helpful to you anymore. But how many of us, how often, have been halfway through rural Wisconsin insisting that we're still in Cloquet because we won't put down the map? I won't see it as untrue. It's the only map I have. I absolutely insist the explanation has to be identical with reality. And it continues to not happen. Isn't that frustrating when that happens? That person you have in your life was just a jerk. They're just irredeemably bad and awful. And then they brought in Christmas cookies and they were delicious. Now what do you do? What do you do? Your world just got complicated. And the person you hold in the highest esteem ever, the most loving, compassionate, expansive, amazing, Thich Nhat Hanh person you have in your life, said something short and trite and kind of mean. Now what do you do? You don't have a map anymore. What are you going to do? And most of us make an unconscious choice in that moment to disregard one of those two things because we want the map to make sense. Or we'll add the explanation. Oh, super nice person, just a bad day. Right? Or a really mean person, and maybe those cookies were given to them by somebody else. Right? Because I really want my map to... I don't want to live in the tension of not knowing. I don't want to live in that. It's very hard for me to live in that as a human being. And the point of teachings like this, the point of Zazen, when moment after moment we let go of the map and return to that which is fundamentally unknowable, is to prevent us from falling back into these patterns, to prevent us from getting smug. If nothing else, to help us see that the map is a fiction. And it's a really useful fiction, but it's still just a map. And when I'm lost in the landscape of Minnesota, having a Minnesota map, yeah, it helps me. But I'm not going to take a day trip on that piece of paper. It's a symbol. It's a map. My ideas about my relationship are not the relationship. My ideas about my own life are not my life. And I know that they're not because my ideas are finite. All my ideas about that relationship, those are finite ideas. My ideas about practice, even my loftiest ideas about practice, are still finite. And Dogen insists, as does Nagarjuna, it's not finite. You got to let go of all of your ideas of even finite and infinite to touch the truth. So when Dogen says you're sitting Zazen and affects everything in all time, past, present, and future in all the 10 directions, he's pointing to this thing you can't find a barrier to. Your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. That one always makes me feel good. That one's never irritating to me. But the hardest part for me is to let go of that as an idea. Because I love that idea, and it's a fine idea. But my idea of it sometimes prevents me from feeling it. My ideas about my life oftentimes get in the way of my experiencing them. We're told that life is unbounded. It is not finite. Birth and death are one thing. We're exposed to a lot of these kind of ideas at Zen centers. Your life didn't begin when you thought it did. It doesn't end the way you think it does. Reality is undivided and infinitely spacious. We're exposed to these kind of things all the time so that we continue to see the gate that we create, the boundary that we create, the fence that we create, the glass ceiling that we create. So the teaching, you're always arriving, is true and not true. The teaching, you never arrive, is true and not true. Don't let yourself get smug. Don't let your practice get smug. Let it be fire. Fire is never smug, it is never complacent. For although fire is confident in its full identity as complete fire, it also knows there is always more to burn. Fire knows that burning is its activity, not its identity. Zazen, sitting zazen. There are no enlightened people, there's only enlightened activity. Do you see the difference there? We are activity. We're activity. We're activity. We're not identity. We're activity. You see where we get stuck? We're activity. So we don't stop. We don't land. We don't end. Enlightenment is activity. It isn't identity. So that's the circle of the way. So what counts as enlightened activity? And I'll end with this, I think, because there's a lot of kind of meat in this, and I don't want to go too long. Suzuki tells us there are no enlightened people, there is only enlightened activity. Okay. There is only activity. Okay. Enlightened activity. So as a practitioner, I am beholden upon myself. I'm self-responsible enough to know I have to start asking myself some questions around what enlightened activity is. What's our metric? We have something in Buddhism called the precepts. We ask questions about the nature of enlightened activity. What separates enlightened activity from non-enlightened activity? And we do need to investigate this question. It's really important we spend time with the ethical component of Buddhism and the rules and the ideas and the concepts laid down 2,500 years ago around ethics socially, ethics as far as how we treat ourselves, ethics around intimate relationships still apply because human culture and relationships haven't changed that dramatically. And they're also seen, especially in Zen, as doorways. They are doorways. They are not absolutes in Zen. They are doorways. The precepts and the prohibitions around ethical behavior are doorways. That does not mean we discount them. But it also doesn't mean that the finite words and the ideas that they represent on the page are where that teaching begins and ends. It's an invitation to deeper inquiry. Right? We talk about this a lot with initiates when they're going to take the precepts, because we talk about the precepts and what they mean and how Zen understands them as Dharma gates, as a gate to a teaching. You know, our first prohibition is I won't kill. I will not kill. That sounds pretty straightforward. Okay, I get that. Until I spend about 5 minutes looking at it and realize that's impossible. To be alive is to kill. I mean, I ate breakfast. And even if I didn't have bacon, I had something. It used to be alive. It died, so I could eat it. It's pointing to how are you going to be in relation with a universe that demands that you are alive because of things dying, and Dhammayan demands that you will die so that other things may live, and you're also in part of a tradition that insists that you understand that those things are both different and not different. It really is an invitation to tremendously deep inquiry about the nature of life and death and suffering. Right? Because the spirit of all those things is about, I want to live in a way that causes as little suffering as possible, that cultivates as much wisdom and compassion as possible. I don't want to get caught by my ideas. I want to see the limitlessness of wisdom. I want to grow into the limitlessness of compassion. So we start by investigating our activity. We need some kind of a metric. And I do encourage people, investigate this in your own life, but please do this just every once in a while. Do it, but up to a point. And the reason I'm saying that, everybody's different, so do what you need to do for yourself, but we don't want this to turn into a strictly abstract conceptual idea. This Zen practice is always about felt, lived experience of suffering and of life and of death. So we want to revisit questions like this, but only now and again. And the reason is because we don't want to land. There isn't an answer. There isn't an answer. There's just a question to live in relationship to. Do not kill. I vow not to kill. That's a koan. You're not going to arrive. I hope you don't. Please don't. Right? You can have a skillful response. You can live with that question long enough to be in relationship to it and have it show up in your life. Good. Have it affect your behavior? Yes. The way you think? Good. But do you understand what I'm saying? Don't have it land in your heart as being the answer. Because now the world is too small, and now, like most people, you'll start to impose that idea on others because you think you've arrived. Right? I know what the walker is, and I know what walking is. So we don't want to kid ourselves. We want patterns. We want explanations. We are humans. It's lovely that we have that. That tendency has served us well. It's also caused a tremendous amount of suffering. Our desire to believe in the pattern. Our desire to believe in the explanation. It's funny, we stop seeing then. When I have my idea about who you are, I stop seeing you. I just see my idea. You know? When I've arrived and I know what Zen is, I stop seeing Zen. I only see my map, and the only time I even become aware of the fact of a map is when I start sharing my notes with you and I realize you have a different Zen than I do. You know, and then I guess we have to figure out which one of us is right. You know? Ugh. Right? Can we agree that the sunset is beautiful? I don't know. It makes me sad. It reminds me of the time that so-and-so died. And for you, it fills you with joy and hope. Do we have to agree? Is that beautiful or is that not beautiful? Nagarjuna, you know, the sunset is beautiful, the sunset is not beautiful. The sunset is both beautiful and not beautiful. The sunset is neither beautiful nor not beautiful. This is not a good conversation to have in the face of an actual sunset, you guys. You'll kill it dead. You will kill it dead. Just have the feeling you're having, right? But maybe the truth of your experience can come out in, this is how I feel when I see that. This is how I feel. Instead of me needing to assert it. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful sunset. I've just given you my opinion. That is an assertion. I have insisted that it has an abiding quality called beautiful. And I'm insisting. I'm the one. I'm separate. It is separate from me. I'm abiding. It is abiding. Busho says sunset is beautiful. We are done talking about it. Right? Unless you don't experience it that way. Now you see the hollowness of my assertion. You've given me an explanation. You've given me an opinion. You've given me a map. And it's none of those things. It's none of those things. It's light disappearing. Whew. I don't know how you experience that. I have no idea how you experience that. Tell me. Don't give me your opinions. Tell me how you experience it. That's what we're invited in. That deep intimacy with our own experience and that ability to connect that deeply with others. So, I encourage you to keep playing with your map. I encourage you to keep noticing your map. I encourage you to live in this delicious tension that Dogen creates around your practice being a circle, the delicious tension that Nagarjuna leaves us when he says, in seeing things, to exist or to not exist, we fail to see a world at ease. Right? Again, it comes back to suffering and the release of suffering. That's what we do in Buddhism. It's what we do in Zen. That's why we're here. I challenge myself to let go of my ideas of existence and non-existence so that I can have an experience of a world at ease. I can see what's really here, a world at ease. And then I can practice that. I can spread that. I can be that in the world, a world that so desperately insists on its existence and its non-existence, and a world that so rarely feels ease. It's our bodhisattva vow to be a presence that is non-anxious and wise and loving, to give the world the medicine it needs, to give ourselves the medicine we need. So That's why teachings like this exist, and I hope this has been helpful. Thank you very much. We have a few minutes if folks have thoughts about that or questions about that or experiences that speak to this kind of stuff. Oh, hi, David. All right.
You said something about understanding relationships.
Yes.
So I'm a marriage and family therapist. And the way I view this is couples come to me with a set of particularly painful delusions.
Yeah.
Threaten the continuity of the relationship. And what I'm doing is trying to help them find a different set of delusions. Less painful, less threatening to the relationship.
Yeah. That's brilliantly said. That's exactly what it is. Actually, do you guys get why?
Yeah.
That is, it's hilarious, but I really get. Like, he's aware, like, I'm replacing this unskillful map with a map that's equally fictional, equally delusional, and yet this is going to be helpful, right? And I do think there's a reason, like, right effort on the Eightfold Path comes before right mindfulness, which comes before right absorption. First you start recognizing, wow, this pattern hurts. Replace it with a pattern that doesn't. Replace it with a pattern that's helpful. Is it still just a made-up? Yeah, of course. But I can't... Does that make sense? There's a logical sequence to this. Thank you, David. That's exactly right. Yeah. David Benson, marriage and family therapist. If you want to understand your relationship, don't come to me. He's your guy. Deb.
So I have a question. If a writer like Toni Morrison, a viewer as a writer,
mm-hmm.
she doesn't write a single another word, like... She can't write anymore. It's writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
Is she still a writer? Or, you know, then there's this concept of my in life, my work is complete. That, or if a musician becomes tone deaf, they cannot play another note of music.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of that sense of tragedy, but are they no longer a musician? There's kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Music, musician. Or even being a doctor, I don't buy that label. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
I'm a doctor, I'm not a doctor, I'm both a doctor and not a doctor. I'm neither a doctor nor not a doctor. You know, it's kind of like, no, this is not my identity.
Yeah.
This is something I do.
Yeah.
When I retire, my work is complete, but mm-hmm. not my practice ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's practice.
Yes, we do practice medicine. That's
so
right.
I think there's that in how we identify ourselves, our professions, our abilities,
mm-hmm.
being a Zen priest.
Yeah. Who am I when I'm wearing my like Led Zeppelin t-shirt and shorts? Is that still being a priest? I mean, am I punched out?
Or
am I off duty? Or I can flip people off in traffic because I'm not doing, I'll do it later. I'm going to be compassionate and wise today from 10 till 2. But after that, I'm just going to be a normal citizen's way. I love, that's exact. Well, you were in the Nagarjuna class, of course, and we played so much with this. And it is interesting, you know, we practice medicine, but we perform surgery. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. So I guess surgery is a performance because they do it in the theater. Whereas medicine is just... When I go to see my GP next to me, like, no, I don't want practice. I love that. The only thing I can say is I just met with a... I'm a spiritual director. It's one of the things I do for a living. And I was just meeting with a very dear friend of mine whose father-in-law was retiring at 84, I think. And it was the most agonizing thing he's ever done because he is that thing. I forget what he did. He's a writer. I'll just say he's a writer. He is a writer. That's what he's here to do. And so now he doesn't do that, and so now he has gone from being a writer to being nothing. Right? And so all of us in this room are not him, and so we can see the total fallacy of that. And we all want to reach out to the stranger and go, sweetheart, no. Your life did not just end. This doesn't diminish you even one little bit. It's very easy for us to see his map and to see the suffering that that map creates, the limitation that's there, and go, no, 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 no. You're creating your own suffering. He doesn't want to get out of bed. He's just like, what? Why? Wow, right? But my pattern, my map, I have such a hard time seeing it. Your map, you have such a hard time seeing it, right? That's why I want to sit down opposite Ted, right, or Tim, or Ben, or sit down with somebody and say, show me the thing that I don't see. You have a chance because you're outside of me to see where I'm, here's where I'm going to get stuck. Here's the glass ceiling. They're going to show you, oh, I get it. This is the thing you think is true. Here's the thing you think is a limit. Like, this is the guy who's a writer, and so I'm not writing. I am therefore not a writer, and that's who I am. I am therefore not. And they can show you, oh, there's a limit there. And that suffering is real. I'm not, right? I'm not taking away that. I appreciate that your experience is very real, but the map that gets you there, the belief that gets you there, is hurting you so much. Please put that down. That belief is poison, and you keep drinking it. Please stop. And there's a way of doing that with great compassion, with great wisdom. That's why we have teachers. That's why we have Sangha, I think. Thank you, Deb. I think that's so helpful. Gary. Oops.
On that, what is Yogi,
Nagarjuna, Nagarjuna, we say it both ways. Yep.
And or Buddha say about these, all of what you're seeing seems like our human attempt to escape our mortality.
Mm.
You know, to be something, mm-hmm. right? To be able to point to I am in this, I am that, I, it's our fear of death, mm-hmm. ultimately. Do you think any of those in Zen, you know, say something about, you know, our, that fear that we're born with?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
We are born with it, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's a great question. Because I don't have time. I'll give you the short one, which is Zen does the Nagarjuna answer. Yeah, we are born and we die. That is true. And no, we do not. And the fear that I have around my own extinction, use that as fuel. You know, when we hit the Han, whack, 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 the verse that's written on the Han is said to be carried then into the air. The verse that says, life and death is a great matter. All things pass quickly away. Awaken, awaken, take heed. Do not waste this precious life. Like, you are going, gone, sport. So use this time well. Right? Go and do it. This is your chance for liberation. Do the practice. You know, we're supposed to use that fear as fuel. And at the same time, life and death are just a dance. They're the ornaments of the Buddha. We're just playing. We play on the ocean of life and death. There's nothing to be feared. So I'm not helping you at all. I'm giving you both. Zen totally reifies both. Like, yeah, yeah. You, and I think the reason is because that's such a highly personal landscape. You've got the peace that's to be found there would never be in somebody else's words or teaching. That's something so primal. We have to find it here. Thank you, though. I love that that's in there. Thank you all very much. Wish we had more time.